From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, I'll talk with the State Fair's cheese lady.
Then I'll catch up with Richard McCoy to find out what is going on in Columbus, Indiana.
And I'll get a sneak peek of the new documentary about Crispus Attucks High School. And we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Sarah, the cheese lady, used to have a different last name. That was before she discovered her unusual calling, crafting sculptures out of enormous blocks of cheese. Well, Sharon just had to find out more about Sarah's appearance at this year's Indiana State Fair.
Forgive the really obvious question, but how does someone get into the line of work of a cheese sculpting?
Well, it is indeed a niche. A niche career.
Yeah.
But it's because as a kid, I was always drawing. Draw. That's all I did. And color and draw and do art projects. My whole family was very artistic. So we were always doing art projects. And so when I grew up, I knew I had to do something with art. So I decided to go to tech school for a commercial art advertising degree.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually was hired by the Dairy Farmers of Wisconsin and worked for them as their artist. And that's where, of course, I ran into cheese and cheese carving.
Sure.
Because it's Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's all about the cheese in Wisconsin. And
we're in
Indiana, we're not far from Wisconsin, so we're familiar.
Right. And that's where I was born. So I'm a natural-born cheesehead.
I hear it in your voice still. Southern California has not taken your accent away, and I'm glad for that.
Oh, I don't have an accent, you know.
Oh.
They do.
Got it. Say no more. So your first project, how did that happen?
Wow, my first project actually was when I was on staff at Wisconsin Milk Marketing, ADA of Wisconsin. We were doing the old-fashioned slideshow, plunk, plunk,
mm-hmm.
plunk. And we were doing a slideshow for how cheese is made, the art of cheese making. And I was perplexed. What kind of cover? So I got the idea to do a woodcut style cheese carving.
Ooh.
For the title slide, The Art of Cheese Making. And that was in 1981. So I did my very first cheese carving in 81, but I really didn't think about it. It didn't click home. And I would hire people to carve for us for events and just loved seeing the carvings and did a few with them at trade shows when we would go to the big food shows. And again, I never thought anything of it until many years later I left the company and they called to hire me to Sarah. Now you can carve cheese for us. So I did. And I would just carve cheese when they called. I was busy. I'd moved on to Cincinnati by then and worked at another grocery store, Jungle Jim's, great big international grocery store, international market. And so I was their artist and manager of creative services, and I didn't need more to do, but whenever Wisconsin would call, I would carve and ship, or I would go and travel and go to some of their trade shows and store openings. But it just grew and grew and grew till pretty soon I was so busy carving cheese, I was calling in sick to work.
And you said, I think this is my career now.
Yeah, so I luckily my boss was very understanding and an entrepreneur himself. So he did let me ease my way out, and eventually I had to quit my real job to do my unreal job of cheese carving.
So forgive me for not knowing this. Are there a lot of people who carve cheese?
No, there are not. Professionally, it's me. I'm the only full-time sculptor.
Wow.
There's another fellow in Wisconsin, Troy. He carves cheese for he, but he is also a chef and a winemaker, so he's it's one of his careers.
Sure.
In food, you'll see his work if you go to the internet and Google. That's how you can see my stuff. Just Google cheese carving.
Yeah.
And hundreds of pictures show up. You'll see my work and Troy's work, but most of it's me.
It feels like somewhere down the road, if you ever have spare time, you need to start, I don't know, an apprentice program,
absolutely,
a school.
Absolutely, I do. I need to find an apprentice.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to last forever. My arms are going to wear out, and I'll need helpers. So, yeah, I do need to find apprentices.
So, talk to us about the technical side. Did you start out using wood carving tools, or how did you figure out what tools to use, and what are your primary tools?
Well, my primary tools and basically what I use 90% of the time are ceramic ribbon loop tools. They're wire loop tools. They're flat bands of wire that ribbon wire. You know, they're kind of flat wire, and they're very basic tools that you carve and do pottery work with.
Mm-hmm.
But the people at Wisconsin, we had done cheese carving for years, and the people who were carving cheese, actually, we had a fellow, Alan Hendricks, who did, he would do seminars on how to carve cheese because it was a great merchandising tool for Wisconsin, and deli clerks or chefs would do carvings in the store, and it was a great merchandising tool. It's also a very cool item to put in a buffet, especially if you want to get a message across or your logo into the buffet without a paper sign.
Right.
And some of them are beautiful and huge, 6 feet long, 200 pounds, 500 pounds. The carvings I do for Indiana State Fair, this one will be about 1,800 pounds. The largest sculpture I've ever carved for Indiana State Fair was the 2,500 pounds for the Year of Dairy Cows. That was one of my favorite carvings I've ever done.
That's not too long ago.
By 7 feet wide and had 2,500 pounds of cheese in it.
Wowza.
They can be bigger.
So, I mean, just even thinking about the creation of the raw material, that's a big custom job, and then it's got to be shipped.
Well, listen to this. I use cheese that's made every day. The cheese I use at Indiana State Fair is made at Pace Dairy in Crawfordsville, and they make the big 640-pound blocks. The cheese industry has been making 640-pound blocks since the 50s. It's the standard for large cheese manufacturing all over the country. It's very common. It's as common as oats.
And is it... to whom is that generally sold? Is it sold to restaurants
size? 640-pound blocks are used. They're sent to cutting plants, and they're cut down into the little 1-pound, 8-ounce bars that you buy at the grocery store. They're shredded. They're used in the food industry to grind down and make cheese spreads and sauces, and it's ground up and dried for powders. This is the way cheddar, Monterey Jack, Pepper Jack, Colby Jack, a lot of your high-volume cheeses are made this way. And the interesting thing is, this is a cool thing. Imagine 640-pound block. It is only 28 by 28 by 22 inches.
It's that
not
dense.
Very big. Cheese is very dense.
Yeah.
And think about this. It takes, for a 640-pound block, it takes 10 pounds of milk to make 1 pound of cheese. So that 640-pound block represents 6,000 pounds of milk.
And
think of the dairy cow. The average dairy cow gives 72 pounds of milk a day. So it takes a lot of dairy cows to make one 640-pound block. Now multiply that by hundreds and hundreds every day, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Think of those big tankers driving down the highway.
Yeah.
And that is not a lot of milk. It's just the milk industry, and in Indiana, it is huge. Now, besides cheese, think about fluid milk. That's the milk you drink in the jug. A jug of milk, a gallon of milk, weighs about 8.9 pounds. So just round it off. When you're talking about math, I'm not very good at math, but let's round that off to 10 pounds,
sure,
just for visual. And that 10-pound gallon of milk shrinks down to be 1 pound of cheese, a 1 pound bar that you buy at the grocery store. So it is incredible the volume of milk that it takes to meet the demand for cheese in America.
And we love our cheese, and you've just given people the economics behind why cheese is priced as it is.
Well, cheese is a very, very good food value.
Right.
When you think about condensing 1 gallon of milk down into 1 pound of cheese, 1 ounce of cheese equals an 8-ounce glass of milk. That's about an inch size cube, inch by an inch by an inch cube, equals an 8-ounce glass of milk. So think of the dense nutrition you're getting when you buy cheese.
Yeah.
It's almost a miracle food.
It is. So
it
what?
It really is. It's serious stuff.
It is.
And then, of course, why do you drink milk? 3 glasses a day gives you your daily nutrition need intake and provides you with calcium, protein, riboflavin, thiamine, zinc, potassium, vitamin B12, vitamin D, which is essential for the absorption of all your calcium and all these nutrients. Vitamin D is key. That's why we say go outside and play.
Right,
that's
exactly
why there's vitamin D added into our milk and added into a lot of foods, so that our bodies, who hang out in the house and play computer games, are getting our vitamin D. But that is why dairy, if you're going to choose a fat in your diet, cheese is a miracle, marvelous food, and milk, and yogurt, and cottage cheese, and sour cream, and ice cream, and all the dairy products.
Sure.
Are also a very nutritious way to eat.
Absolutely, absolutely. What are your primary cheeses that are best to work with for carving?
Well, I use a lot of cheddar. Cheddar is very dense and consistent. It holds up well, tastes great. Oh, and you can get 640-pound blocks. And in other states, they make cheese wheels up to, I commonly work with 500-pound wheels, 1,000, 2,000 pounds, 5,000 pounds, 10,000 pound, and 12,000 pound cheddars. A 12,000 pound cheddar is 10 feet in diameter by 10 feet tall.
Wow.
But those are cheeses from Wisconsin, very old-fashioned cheese cylinders. But the squares, the big 640s, 40-pound blocks, and Indiana is big in manufacturing of cheddar and Gouda, and the Swisses, the Emmentaler-type Swisses,
mm-hmm,
and you see pepper jack, string cheese, cheeses like that in Indiana. And then also, but remember, fluid. Fluid milk is the biggie in Indiana.
Sure.
Most of our milk goes into fluid milk, the kind you buy, your milk that you drink.
Tell me one or two of your favorite carvings you've ever done.
At Indiana, I would got to say one of my favorites was Year of Dairy Cows. That was in 2011, and that was the ADA has their mascot, Buttercup.
Sure.
And Buttercup, the cow, is darling. She's a Holstein, black and white Holstein.
And she's very girly.
Sitting on her dairy throne, which looked a little bit like a barn throne. And to her left and to her right were these cheese-carved, animated milk carton, sour cream, yogurt, the grilled cheese sandwich, all the different dairy products, including cheese chunk and cheese wheels. They all had faces, and they were all kind of dancing around to her left and her right. And she's sitting on this big throne, and down below her feet is like the front of a barn. And there were 6 windows with the heads of the dairy cows, the 6 milking breeds, dairy cows represented with their heads sticking out of the barn, looking in different directions, and it represented all the major six breeds for the dairy industry. It was absolutely darling. It was a monster, though. It took me 150 hours in 10 days.
Wow.
That's two all-nighters. So when I'm carving at Indiana State Fair, I am carving. It's cheese to chisel for 10, 15, 20 hours a day. And I have a couple of helpers that help me. My husband, Cheese Boy, he helps. Wow, it's quite a process.
Sharon Gamble with Sarah the Cheese Lady, also known as Sarah Kaufman. You can meet her and see her giant sculpture for this year's Indiana State Fair in the Purdue Ag Court building starting this Friday, August 5th. You can talk with her and ask questions while she works, and be prepared to learn lots of new fun facts about cows and the dairy business and, of course, cheese. Sarah's creation will have its grand unveiling on Wednesday, August 10th at noon. After that, the sculpture will remain on display for the rest of the fair. And you can find out more about Sarah at sarahcheeselady.com. That's Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, sarahcheeselady.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Columbus, Indiana is known as the Athens of the Prairie, featuring 8 mid-century modern National Historic Landmarks. Recently, a new wave of young designers and supporters are aiming to reinvigorate this design heritage for the 21st century. A newly formed advocacy and action group called Landmark Columbus, led by Richard McCoy, has announced plans for Exhibit Columbus, a biannual design exhibit to start in the fall of 2017 with an inaugural symposium, Foundations and Futures, coming up this fall. Travis DiNicola spoke with Richard McCoy to find out more.
Richard, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Absolutely. Lots of stuff going on down in Columbus. I mean, we had you on the show a little while back, sort of when you were first talking about developing this whole Exhibit Columbus idea and trying to bring designers and more things going on to Columbus. And I can't wait to hear sort of everything that's been happening. First off, though, congratulations on being on the cover of Nuvo last week. That was cool.
Well, thanks. What fun it is to be on the cover of Nuvo. It's such an icon for Indiana, and I hope that I did it justice, you know.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent work. So Exhibit Columbus, it all comes out of the history of the great architecture, mid-century modernism that Columbus features 8 buildings on the historic landmarks list. But there's still so much more going on than just what the history is. And that's really what you're trying to develop and promote.
That's right. You know, so last time I was here, we were talking about Landmark Columbus, which is the organization we created that's built to care for things. And one of the things we wanted to do in Columbus is to push it forward.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to answer the question of what's next in Columbus. Columbus has this iconic status in America as being one of these small American cities that are just sort of jewels, mm-hmm. and places that you must see. And it's great to have it here in the state of Indiana. But so what we wanted to do with Exhibit Columbus is find a way to investigate this question of what's the future of Columbus.
Okay.
And this was, you know, I have a team that works with me on the project, and they're really the brains behind it. But it took us coming together and telling some stakeholders in Columbus and Indianapolis an uncomfortable kind of truth, in that Columbus has become known for what it did,
mm-hmm.
not what it's doing.
Not what it's doing now.
And so this is a real effort to sort of change that and to say Columbus is still a progressive, visionary city in America that has ideas that will show the world that design matters, mm-hmm. that good design matters, and architecture is at the heart of what makes a place great.
So what made it ripe for the great architecture it now boasts, what made it ripe then, still exists today, just in new forms, in new ways. What is that? And how are you going to encourage that, right?
Right. So what we call Exhibit Columbus a biennial exploration of architecture, art, design, and community.
Okay.
And so we really want to use this as a platform to explore those topics. And we do it in a biennial format, so we're going to do something different each year. And so we start this year with really a fantastic one-of-a-kind symposium that we call Foundations and Futures. And in this, we've invited a number of experts to come and talk about Columbus. And then next year, we're going to have really a first-of-its-kind exhibition of temporary architecture and art that is all built in response to some of these national historic landmarks and some of these buildings that are built by the world's best designers.
Right. Well, let's start by talking about foundations and futures, because that's coming up at the end of September. And so it's a 4-day symposium featuring some really, amazing architects and designers that you're bringing in.
That's right. And so the core of the symposium is 2 days, but we have some things built around it. And so, you know, really the highlight, to start with the highlight at the symposium, we've brought back some Columbus legends to sort of talk about their career and how it influenced them. So we have Deborah Burke, who is the first female dean of the Yale School of Architecture starting this fall, and the woman who's building a building for Cummins right downtown here in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and she was in town, about 6 months ago, and just everyone who heard her speak just couldn't say enough great things about her.
I think that lecture was sold out. It was really a great event. So we have Deborah Burke, and then we have Robert Stern, who built Columbus Regional Hospital, the main nonprofit hospital in Columbus, and is the outgoing dean of the Yale School of Architecture.
Okay.
It's an interesting time to have the two of them in town. And then we also have Michael Van Valkenburg, who in 1992 made a revolutionary an excellent park in Columbus called Milrace Park that really changed the way that Columbus uses parks. And today, Van Valkenburg is a world-famous designer who just completed a huge renovation of the Brooklyn waterfront. So three sort of legends coming home to Columbus that really had their early career, sort of marked by Columbus. And then we're going to have Will Miller, the youngest son of J. Irwin and Xenia S. Miller, in town to kind of moderate a discussion. So
The Millers who really made so much of this possible originally.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so that's the keynote. But we also have three other sessions there, and I'm excited about them. The first session, we bring in some international architectural historians, and so we have Jochen Eisenbrunn from the Vitra Design Museum in Germany. We have Alexander Lang from New York, Marlene Newman from IU, in a morning sort of talking about the history. And then in the afternoon on Friday, we have a number of stakeholders in Columbus sort of talking about how they made things and how they maintain them. So one is Mary Chandler, the new director of the Cummins Foundation. We have Jeff Brown, whose family built the Republic Building, a National Historic Landmark. Ben Weaver, who works at the IMA and takes care of the Miller House and Garden. And then the next day on Saturday, we have this really interesting session that I don't think has ever been done. We have really international leaders in making coming to discuss the future of making in Columbus. And so this is a session put together by our friend at Ball State University, Kevin Klinger. And we're having Mark Burry from Australia, who led the way to sort of figure out limestone in La Sagrada Familia, the Anton Gaudi Church in Barcelona.
Sure.
And then Matthias Kroller and Fabio Grimazio, two folks that are leading in building buildings with robots and drones, if you believe me.
Okay.
And then Jen Rumsey, the first female chief technical officer of Cummins Inc., and Bill Zahner, who was famous for helping Frank Gehry figure out how to make those crazy metal skins on buildings. And so
this is a pretty amazing, pretty impressive group that you're bringing together, and some really sort of heady and heavy discussions about architecture and design and space. What sort of audience are you looking for? Is this more academic? Are you hoping to see a lot of architects and artists there? Is this something that the general public can get into? I mean, certainly community leaders in Columbus would want to be there, but I would also imagine from other parts of the state.
Yeah, well, first, we've tried to keep it as affordable as we can, so the door's wide open. And so it's $60 for 2 days or $35 a day. And so for a symposium of this quality, you know, we feel like it's really a cheap way to get in. But, you know, going back to sort of that tagline, we want architecture folks there, we want art folks there, we want design folks, and we want community. And so I think this hopefully opens up a door for people around the state and around the Midwest to look at Columbus as a place that invested in the value of good design that paid off in huge dividends. And those dividends today are the highest per capita income, lowest unemployment in the state, huge giving community, high education. And so part of this is a way for us in Columbus to kind of celebrate and say, you know, this is who we are, this is what we built, and this is where we're going in the future, and trying to invite as many people as we can to come to the table and think about it with us.
So how is this discussion, this symposium, foundations and future, going to then play into, affect, influence the work that you're doing in 2017 that you had alluded to earlier?
Right. Well, so That's a great question. I left out part of the symposium, and so for that we'll explain that. And so what we're doing in 2017, the centerpiece of it is what we're calling the J. Irwin and Xenia S. Miller Prize competition.
Okay.
And so we're naming this after two of America's greatest patrons of architecture and art in the Miller family, and a family that's, you know, an unparalleled commitment to community and to human rights and all sorts of really powerful things. And so in this Miller Prize competition, we've invited 10 leading artists and designers and architects to compete one-on-one for an opportunity to build a temporary installation in 2017.
Okay.
So all 10 of those folks will be interwoven into the symposium and here at the symposium. So this is a way for the community to get to know a new set of designers, for the region to get to know them, and then also just as much for the designers to get to know this context that they're then going to be...
Get to know the community they're then be competing to build in.
That's right. And so
now when you say a temporary building pop-up, what do you envision? I mean, what does that mean? So it's not a permanent structure that's going to be created.
That's absolutely not. And so it's not architecture. You know, we're not going to pour any foundations. And so this is, you know, this has become a kind of popular thing to build temporary installations or these kind of pavilions. And, you know, they're sort of it, what's interesting is that, you know, I get this question a lot.
It's more than just a tent.
Right. It's absolutely more than just a tent. Part of it is, and I don't mean to cheat on this, I don't know what they're going to build.
Yeah.
And that's the fun part. But what I know is that we've selected 10 outstanding artists and architects that can do this really well. And what we're doing is then trying to match them with local fabricators, local material resources, and other things so that they're also getting to explore some of the things we make in the Midwest.
Okay.
And so I don't know exactly what they're going to make, but I know the spaces that they're going to work in. And so they're going to be working in
context. It's also more than just sculpture, though, because then the idea is that you are creating some sort of space or environment that will be utilized, right?
That's right. And so we want them to be spaces the community feels comfortable gathering in. We want them to be things that are visually exciting, intellectually engaging. And so in the same way, trying to sort of get around to a lot of folks in the same place. But, you know, some of them will be installed in and around trees. One will be installed on a brick plaza. And so I think not knowing what they are is part of the fun.
So all 10 artists will actually have a chance to build their pieces, or will they just submit their designs?
Yeah, so these 10 artists and designers will be in Columbus and in 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to learn about Columbus. We're going to learn about them. They go home. They make their designs, and then they come back and present their designs in Columbus in December to a jury.
Mm-hmm.
That jury then will select 5 winners who will be given an award to build their installation, and they'll be given about 8 months to do it.
Great. So we can expect to see stuff by about this time next year?
That's right.
Roughly?
Yeah, no, actually, and so this is a big part, is we also want to have the exhibition incorporate some of the building. We want people to come see these things get built in the fall of 2017. So it's not just about the finished project. You know, Columbus has always been about the process of design and trying to solve problems through design and using art to really celebrate a place.
So I'm sure, you know, artists and architects love this and love the thoughtfulness and intention of it and the process. What are you hearing from just, you know, people who live in Columbus, work in Columbus, you know, that are hanging out, that are hearing about these, you know, big ideas?
Yeah, so it's, you know, Columbus is a sophisticated town. There's a lot of smart folks that know about architecture and art. Mm-hmm. And so those folks are really excited about it. And then there's other folks that recognize that, you know, this is a community that's really built its identity through architecture and art. So even if they don't really get it in terms of they're not fans of architecture and art, they know that this is significant and important. But there are still plenty of folks that don't quite get it, you know, aren't sure exactly what this is going to look like, how it's going to work. And that's part of the excitement. I think we will all know a lot more by this time next year,
sure.
Exactly what this is. And so, you know, this is a first of its kind event.
And part of the project, I would imagine, is actually doing this sort of community outreach as well to help people who live there sort of understand what the whole purpose is.
Absolutely. And also taking that feedback into the project and into the plans that we have involved with it. And so when I talk about the Miller Prize competition, that's one of 4 key components to exhibit Columbus in 2017. We've also invited 5 leading graduate schools in architecture and design to come build temporary installations in the same way as the leading designers will, except they're going to build them around an elementary and a middle school. So kids in town get to see him.
Oh, cool.
So we have Ball State University, University of Michigan, University of Cincinnati, Kentucky, the Ohio State University, all coming to do a design build in the city. So we're going to get to see that. We're going to have projects built by middle schoolers and high schoolers in Columbus. So the community
That's
is going to actually see it. And then we're also going to have other things that deal with design at a different scale along Washington Street, sort of the main street.
Yeah.
And so this is going to be a big kind of festival of architecture, art, design, and community all in one space. And so we're excited about it.
Hey, real quick, before I let you go, I know obviously the Miller family is supporting this, the Ephraimson family. You've got some other supporters as well. I know they're helping to make this happen.
Yeah, thanks. We have a number of founding sponsors that have been committed to this project really since the beginning, and it's remarkable the kind of generosity and the leadership that have come forward to support this. And those are, you know, the Columbia Area Visitor, or excuse me, those are the Columbus Area Visitor Center, which we also hope that this is a tourist draw. We have the Columbus Museum of Art and Design. Cummins Inc. is behind it. The Ephraimson Family Fund, as you mentioned, the Haddad Foundation, who have been really supportive of this project since the beginning. Heritage Fund, so the Community Foundation of Bartholomew County, the Irwin Sweeney Miller Foundation, and so this is the Millers Foundation that they're actually it's well known that they're closing this foundation down, and this is going to be one of the last gifts of that foundation. Honored to receive that. Johnson Ventures, a company in Columbus, the Shoemaker family, and Saiho Insurance Services are all, stepped up immediately and answered this challenge of what are we doing in Columbus?
Very exciting. Richard, you got a heck of a year in front of you. I wish you the best with that. I can't wait to hear more.
Thanks so much, and thanks again for having me.
You're very welcome.
Travis DiNicola with Richard McCoy of Landmark Columbus. The symposium Foundations and Futures takes place from September 28th to October 2nd, and you can find out more at landmarkcolumbus.org, landmarkcolumbus.org. Travis?
Yes, Sharon.
Are you ready for funnel cakes, elephant ears, fried corn?
Oh, it is that time again.
It's state fair time.
It is.
Oh, yay. And we have that and some other things to tell you about on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do? Well, I'm looking forward to going to the 924 Gallery, the Arts Council's Gallery, Gallery 924, for the Art Assignment Show. This is Sarah Green's video, videos that she does. If you've seen them, you know that they inspire people to do cool things based on what other artists are doing. That's pretty cool. And a bunch of local artists have created work based on Sarah's Art Assignment videos. And this show is up through August 25th. At the Gallery 924.
Fantastic. If you are going to the Indiana State Fair, and if you're not, what in the world is wrong with you? If you're going to the Indiana State Fair, be sure to visit the Indiana Bicentennial Train. This is the Indiana Historical Society's, I would say it's a moving exhibition. It will be stationary at the State Fair.
It will move you.
It will move you. There you go. It's in Family Fun Park next to the Pioneer Village, and it has fabulous exhibitions inside dedicated to the history of the state and the future of the state. So check out the Bicentennial Train at the Indiana State Fairgrounds and learn lots more.
And, of course, you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis' Indie Arts Guide website, or listen to us next week on the calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Attics, the School That Opened a City, is a new documentary project of WFYI Public Media, Ted Green Films, and Heartland Film. Sharon Gamble invited producer, director Ted Green, and composer-performer Tyron Cooper to tell her about this film that captures the heart and pride of not only a high school, but also its wider community.
I'm looking at Ted for this question. How did this film start?
Well, actually, it started about 11 years ago.
Oh, my gosh.
When I was at the Indianapolis Star. We did a big celebration of the 50th anniversary of the 1955 Crispus Attucks State Championship. They were the first all-black team anywhere in the country. to win a state championship in an open tournament like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of that, we put on a big production at the school where we had people up on stage. It was kind of a town hall meeting, and it ended up being a really big deal. I mean, Oscar Robertson was there up on the stage as well as one of his assistant coaches and several other. George McGinnis didn't even go to Crispus Attucks, but it was kind of a who's who talking about race relations and how basketball affected that and whatnot. Well, anyways, that was all good in theory, but beforehand, as a newspaper hack, I was so nervous. I had no idea how to put something like that on, so I'm walking the halls just fretting and fretting, worried about me. And I saw something that really kind of changed my life. I saw all these graduates, they came, and they came early, and they just wanted to walk the halls and look at the photos on the walls. In case you haven't been over to Crispus Attucks, they have every graduation photo on the wall with all these faces of all the graduates. And to me, it's kind of like a horizontal monument of the African-American experience in Indianapolis. And so I was just watching this, and I'd see these graduates come in, and they have their kids with them, and they'd point to people and say, look, there's your grandmother. And there's your grandfather.
Hmm.
And then they'd walk back about 20 pictures and they'd say, and there's your great-grandmother, and there's your great-grandfather, and there's your uncle, and there's our neighbor. And it hit me like a brick right before the big show that really in some ways I had done the wrong story. I mean, basketball is a beautiful story. It means a lot, but I just saw firsthand, and I saw it in these people's eyes, that there was a much bigger story involving Crispus Attucks High School. And I vowed then and there if I ever got another chance. And here we are a decade later.
And the film is done and soon to be screened.
It's pretty close to done. We are just, in fact,
a little post-production.
Well,
still going
you know,
on.
In fact, we just found an interview, an old taped interview with the first principal. We unearthed it. We thought it was a broken tape. We fixed it. We got a beautiful bite out of it. So we just threw that in there. I mean, you know, this is. At some point, we just have to stop. But it's kind of a living, breathing thing, and we're just trying to do the most justice we can
sure.
to that school.
Tyron, I want to bring you into this. You and Ted have worked together before. Did you grow up here?
No, I'm actually I was born in South Carolina,
okay.
Florence, South Carolina, but I was raised in a small town called Lake Worth, Florida. It's in Palm Beach County, about 15 miles south of West Palm Beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was raised in Florida. I came to Indiana initially to study jazz with the great Professor David Baker to do my master's degree in jazz studies at Indiana Jacobs School of Music. I ended up staying. I actually took a year after I had finished my master's degree,
mm-hmm.
went back to Bethune-Cookman College, which was my undergraduate, where I did my undergraduate work. They had hired me to work as the assistant choral director there, as well as the assistant jazz band director there. But then I got a call at the end of that first year by Indiana University to come back up and interview for a teaching position at Indiana University, and that was in 1999. So I started on as on faculty at Indiana University in 1999, did a short stint there for about 6 years, and went back to school and finished my PhD in ethnomusicology again at Indiana University. And I'm back on faculty currently, assistant professor in African American and African Diaspora Studies Department, where I teach courses primarily in their arts concentration division,
mm-hmm.
Of that program. So that's what I've been doing for the last, I guess, that the turn of the new millennium.
Yeah,
right?
There you go. So you're a Hoosier now.
Yes, I'm a Hoosier. I'm a Hoosier, you know, and I really became a Hoosier once I got married. I met my wife at Indiana University. And so once we finally settled down in the great town of Bloomington, that's when I decided in my heart I'm a Hoosier now.
There you go. So what did you know about Attucks before Ted called and said, hey, I'm working on this film. I think you're the right guy for music.
At the time, I knew Attucks was a historical, really monument. You know, in terms of education and educating African Americans if we understand the history of education prior to integration, African Americans were often taught by people who had master's degrees and PhDs because of segregation. And so many of these people could not get jobs. And so the education system at that point in many schools was really at a high order in terms of the standard and the types of education that was offered to black students at that time. Well, one of my great mentors, David Baker, came out of Crispus Attucks, so I knew that. I knew Oscar Robertson had come out of Crispus Attucks. So I knew that it was a school that produced phenomenal people that have impacted, really, I would say, the world. When you think about jazz education, I mean, David Baker's books is around the world.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about basketball, I mean, nobody was, I mean, it's arguable that anybody was as impactful on basketball as Oscar Robertson. And I'll probably get a lot of phone calls about that one. But I knew Crispus Attucks was very significant to producing high-quality people, not just African-Americans, but true Americans, true people of humanity. And so that's what I knew. And I knew that just by studying with David Baker at Indiana University. The things that he had instilled in us was just I'm still growing from that experience.
Ted, you mentioned in an interview in describing Attucks that it was a school that was set up to fail. Can you say more about that?
Well, I mean, you have to understand the climate, and we spend a lot of time on the film kind of painting a picture of that climate. In the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan ran this state. The governor was Klan-backed, if not an outright Klansman. The mayor was an outright Klansman. All five members of the school board were Klan-backed. It was just, as historian James Madison puts it in the film, it really was the darkest time in Indiana history. While at the same time, because of the northern migration, especially during World War I up from the south, Indianapolis had the highest percentage of African Americans among any major northern city, which is kind of hard to imagine, but it's true. They didn't have as many African Americans as Chicago or Detroit, but the percentage was higher here. So you have that, you know, a very, I'd say, combustible confluence where the school was built to put these people over here,
right,
where you just didn't have to see them. I mean that was the bottom line. And yes, it had a very nice building, but their equipment was certainly secondhand. You know, they didn't have any sports uniforms really to speak of, you know, chemistry stuff. I mean, just you name it. And even the teachers were actually getting paid, you know, far less money. So the idea was, let's put these people over here. Maybe that thing will bump along a little while as maybe a trade school or something. And then who knows? We don't need to think about it anymore. Well, of course, the exact opposite happened because of the incredible teaching and the incredible pride in the way the whole community really fell in line, the African-American community, and this became the epicenter of that community. They took such pride in what that school was able to do. I personally think it's one of the great, the greatest educational triumphs anywhere in the nation.
You know, with the premiere coming up, I know you've both, along with your fellow, your crew members and researchers and so forth, have probably been tackled by people who are like, I want a ticket. I want to hear some of the stories that before we turned the microphone on, you guys were comparing notes about stories that people had said about, I got to see this movie because it's opening the door to go back and revisit this amazing story.
It's taken a lot of us by surprise. I mean, for instance, we had a whole marketing campaign set up to last all summer to try to get butts in seats for the premiere. Well, what happened is shortly after a story ran in the Indianapolis Star, it sold out right away. Interest was so great that we now have a second screening the very next day. The first one is August 18th, the second one is August 19th, and the second one is nearly sold out too. And people were just now getting to actually sending out the actual tickets, and just the reactions for receiving the tickets, it's clear that this has become much more than a film. It's an event. It is sort of like a homecoming. There are people coming from all over the country just come in to be a part of this, which is extremely humbling and not a little stressful.
Nervous making, maybe?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit. But it's like a huge reunion, and people have been saying they've been kind of waiting for an event like this for years. I feel very, very blessed, really, to be a part of that. And, you know, WFYI and I have worked for 2 years on this now, and we have been, just to get back sort of the point here, is that we're so honored to have Tyron working with us again. This is our third film together, but this one, he has just really, really knocked it out of the park.
And I want to start with, where do you start in creating music for a film? And where did you start with this one? Did this change your normal technique at all?
Well, I think this one was a little different than the ones we've done in the past in terms of the process. This was probably the first time, I would say, that we've gotten what we call a locked version, which is, you know, the film that has most of the footage.
What he's not saying is that finally I did it right this time.
There's some giggling and exchange glances over there.
No, what? Well, I actually had a chance to actually see the majority of the footage that I would write music to.
Mm-hmm.
Ted and I have, and along with Pete Satry, who's a great editor, we've developed a relationship, first of all, of dialogue, of constant dialogue, of constant, Ted has the ability to share the story in a way that makes it visible to me before I even see it on the film. And so in the past, I might have had, you know, some snippets of footage or the script, you know, and I would write to those ideas. But that would be after having numerous conversations with Ted and Pete about the aims of the film. And so we've been able to get things accomplished. But, of course, we've evolved to the place where we can, you know, actually write to, well, I have opportunity for this particular film to write to actual, to the bulk of the footage, which made my job a little easier, you know, in a sense.
He's being really nice here, because basically before we were always behind schedule. This time we were on schedule so we could get him a finished part one and say, hey, look at it.
Hey, we're on the radio.
Music to this, man. No, but it does.
That's okay.
There's
only a few people here.
It makes all the difference in the world. And what he's able to do, I mean, it's a magical moment for Pete and I when all of a sudden, you know, we have it all out there and it's dry and we have our imagery and our
quotes. Know what your emotional goal is, but it's the music that pulls it together.
It's unbelievable. And when it comes in and all of a sudden he's... Can I tell you why I hate this man here right next to me? I gotta be honest. What he asked me to do is he take the script and he says, okay, write in your music cues. Write where you see the music and where it should start and where it should stop and you know, how you hear it here. So I go through it very carefully and it should start here and this is kind of soft and maybe now we get a little more soulful and now we pick it up. Well, okay, so then it comes in and it is completely different than what I'd asked for, and invariably much, much, much better. So not only is it just blatant insubordination on his part, but then I'm left to realize just how little I know about music. Well, because what he is able to make our stuff come to life way better than we could have drawn it up ourselves.
Well, I think it really has to do with, you know, truthfully, you know, with a relationship and a sense of trust that we have for each other, for each other's ability to be sound contributors during this creative process. So I trust Ted that, one, he's a great storyteller. Even with this story, if you think about when you see it on the film, you know, sometimes as an African-American, we get these stories on film and it doesn't quite line up with the reality of the community.
Mm-hmm.
But Ted has this uncanny ability to tell the story of the people from the perspective of the people, right? While at the same time making it accessible to mainstream. So everybody can see themselves in some way in the story. And so as a composer, I can too see myself not only as a cultural bearer or a part of the community, but artistically, it's like the film dictates to me what sounds need to be heard, the soundscape of the imagery on the film. And so, I mean, he's a mastermind at that. So what he, you know, while he's putting all of these notes in the film about music cues and what he wants to see, then I go and I weigh that against what I see on the film. And it's like he's really leading me, trust me. he's doing far more than he's giving me credit for. So in a sense, we work together. It's about we've built a relationship over the times that we've worked together in the past. And so we kind of know, we got a kind of ebb and flow of how we work. And it's been working, and I don't think we should change it, Ted. I don't know about you.
Hey, I can't argue with success.
Yeah.
Sharon Gamble with producer, director Ted Green and composer, performer Tyron Cooper. Their new film, Attics, The School That Opened a City, is a collaborative project of WFYI Public Media, Ted Green Films, and Heartland Film. It tells the story of Crispus Attucks High School, an all-black Indianapolis school built in the 1920s when the KKK ruled Indiana and especially its capital city. The first showing of the film is sold out, but a second showing has been added at the Madam Walker Theater on Friday, August 19th at 2 p.m. To get tickets and learn more, visit heartlandfilm.org. Again, heartlandfilm.org. You can also learn more about Ted Green and his other films at tedgreen.com. Again, tedgreen.com. And you can learn more about Dr. Tyron Cooper at indiana.edu. Just search Tyron, that's T-Y-R-O-N, Cooper. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out what Cumberland Arts is up to in its eighth year.
Then I'll get a preview of an Indie Fringe Fest play based on a Vonnegut work.
And I'll check out the Carmel Bands Festival, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.